So this is episode 56 of the Brilliant Podcast. We are going to do a series of three episodes where we largely talk about exclusion. And what's going to be interesting about the conversation we're about to have with this, which I guess I'll let the people I'm talking to introduce themselves, is that I have absolutely no idea what they want to talk about. At least one of these people has been on the podcast before. They've been on a couple recently. And we'll see how things go. Hello. Good evening.
Hi. Soren here.
And I'm Dominique.
Wonderful. So, let's see here. So we're talking about exclusion, and mm-hmm. when I think about exclusion, or at least I'm thinking about it right now, I think about it in the context of how people default to it as a way to deal with like conflict. I mean, I think oftentimes when we talk about like white people culture, mm-hmm. we talk about like the kind of exclusion that happens in white people culture, where, for instance, if you're not considered nice, you get subtly and then not so subtly excluded. I'm curious as to where you all take this concept and idea, and what are your experiences with exclusion?
Well, it was funny to listen to your talk at Bastard about social exclusion. That was kind of fresh in my mind, and then just saw it playing out very in interesting ways in my own life, a very dramatic way. This is a complicated story, so I'm going to give the very simplified nutshell version that I was having problems with roommates.
Actually, before you I will mm-hmm. preface this by saying, for people who don't know, Soren lives in what I call the Oakland group house hell, which there used to be, you know, like 100, if not more, sort of quote unquote radical Oakland group houses, where there would be, you know, between 4 and 10 or 20, mm-hmm. You know, goofball radicals living in this under the same roof.
Yeah.
But as the rents have gone up and as the landlords have gotten more disciplinarian, those households have disappeared. And so now, mm-hmm. while there probably are still dozens, it's not nearly as vital and as exciting as it used to be.
Yeah. And there's just a precariousness about the whole situation at all times. There's condos being put in down the street, and the neighborhood is changing, and you just kind of constantly wonder, like, when are we going to get evicted? When is it going to happen?
Not if, when.
Yeah.
It's basically that stuff is over with. Like, it's collapsing all around us. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think people are, like, flipping out, basically.
Yeah.
So there's just, like, this same kind of dynamic happened with my last housing situation, mm-hmm. which is similar people that I've always tried to avoid this dynamic. And now I'm in the middle of it. And it's like things that maybe like call out culture that we hear about on A News or something, mm-hmm. or that you see these incidents, but it's with like individual people. And it's with roommates, like, but our story is complicated, so maybe it's hard to really describe it, but there's just some of the most intense things where one of my roommates was protesting me in the hallway holding a sign with my name
yeah.
on it.
This same person, I think, I'm assuming it was the same person, also proceeded to glitter bomb the kitchen.
The shared kitchen.
Yes. Also, there were statements written all over the walls. Some of the gems, just focusing on how I'm an Aryan, questioning Dominique's indigeneity, calling me a white trophy girlfriend. That was nice. Let's see. Lots and lots of stuff, accusations of racism. Maybe I should just say a little bit about the story.
Slow down. Yeah. This obviously, it sounds like the ending is going to be funny, but
yeah.
but it needs more setup.
Yeah, so There were some disagreements in the well, actually, let me preface this a little more. I'm 10 years older, at least, than everyone else that I was living with. Everyone else was like in their mid-20s. To early 20s. And I had been there the longest, and I'm what you'd call the master tenant. I'm the only person on the lease agreement. And I collect the rent. I pay the majority of the bills. You know, the PG&E is my name. And I was kind of like, it's been a long time being in this house mom role. Not necessarily out of choice, but it's just how it happened. People move in and out of these group houses kind of all the time. There's a lot of transients. And I just found myself in this position. And one of my roommates really wanted, basically, Dominique to never come over. And I was like, well, why? And their explanation had to do with his energy. And
which fair point.
Yeah, yeah. God.
I'll concede that. But it's
dark
also
cloud.
But this house is also like a queer femme,
yes.
POC, full-on. Full-on, they look at BuzzFeed and are on Tumblr every day, and that they take it really seriously.
Yeah.
With a white house mom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, onward.
Yeah. So after a couple of these meetings and me saying repeatedly that I was willing to negotiate about these things, or like, let's find a solution that works for all of us, and being met with statements of I'm scared of men and no, and I won't negotiate, I kind of said, okay, I'm not going to negotiate anymore either. This resulted in one of my roommates saying that they would give 30-day notice. Another quickly followed suit. Even though she, up until that point, had been very neutral and didn't have a problem like any of them. And also, okay, so I should go back a little bit. So at this point, one of my roommates is effectively squatting their room too. And I have been paying her rent. So that's part of this is unrelated, but happening at the same time. So I am increasingly frustrated about that situation. But the conversation that's happening with most of them is not about the fact that we're all potentially going to get evicted. And it's not about the fact that I'm paying someone else's rent to prevent that from happening. It's about me not creating a safe space.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is funny because obviously the space is unsafe for all of us in that situation. We could, you know.
And ostensibly capitalism makes a fairly unsafe space too.
Yes, yes. So basically the situation devolves pretty rapidly at that point into me being protested, basically. And everyone moving out while also kind of creating this narrative about me evicting them, which is really interesting. Because, I mean, honestly, there's points where I was like, okay, how do I evict them?
Sure.
But there's actually not really a legal way that I could have evicted anyone except the one who was effectively squatting their room.
Right.
And that would have taken 60 days at least.
And did they leave?
They left.
No way. Wow.
They all left in the end. Yeah.
Okay. So this is a conversation about exclusion.
Yeah. I think the reason why I kept kind of turning over what we talked about at Bastard in my head in this is... you had mentioned something about people saying, well, I don't like you, you don't have any friends, as that being this kind of sweeping insult. And it's like being rejected and kind of marked as evil. Maybe I'm not sure what they're excluding me from, but I'm obviously right. being rejected from their world, which is funny because I think they they must believe that they're the kind of like mono worldview
is everywhere.
Is everywhere, and that I would automatically share their values. That I wouldn't question any of these statements, and that like me being called a racist or a fascist, I'd be like, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm a bad white person. Let me please pay your rent.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Did I?
But this is also, it's related to what we think friends are or what our social circle means. Mm-hmm. And that, that they feel like the people on the internet are part of their community.
Right.
And they think that there is a community of nice allies and queer brown people, and I don't think that that's true.
Right.
But in certain ways, we are excluded from
the imaginary community.
From these parties and things like that. Right. But also, I never wanted to go to those parties.
No, of course. But it does hurt to be denied access.
I mean,
that's why they say things like no one wants you to come to the party. Isn't to be like, I didn't want to go anyways, but oh.
At this point in my life, I don't know. I don't know how hurtful that is. I'm like, okay, cool.
I not to cite myself, but the piece that I wrote in Black Seed 4 actually speaks exactly to this point, and it basically says that if you're ever going to create a real human community in the meaningful sense of the word community, rather than the facile sense that I normally see it used and laughingly use it myself. Step one, a land base. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to argue that your home is a land base, like that was where you met these people. That was where you had whatever it was that you were going to have was going to be defined by the fact that you started here. Mm-hmm. Point two, a common language. And step three is time, probably generational time, which is, of course, why your house was never going to become a community, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But that common language, that is what we're talking about. Like, if you're being excluded from something right now, you're excluded because they gave you the tools to speak to them, and you didn't use them.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way to put it. And I did, at times, feel almost as if we were speaking different languages. I mean, I do speak that language. But I was refusing to kind of speak to them in it because I was, at that point, much more concerned about practical matters.
We'll talk about that a little bit. What's your experience of speaking that language, and how did you use it and see through it?
Well, I guess I just mean I feel fairly confident in navigating kind of, this is going to sound snarky, but this like ultra PC safety-oriented rhetoric.
And this is because of college or because of living in Oakland?
No, I never went to college. But I've read Bell Hooks, you know?
I've heard of her.
And this is also what is so funny is I'm an ethnic studies student at like one of the best ethnic studies programs.
In the country, and
I guess maybe I am guilty of elitism because I've read all the theory that people are kind of
unconsciously citing.
Yeah.
It is coming from a lot of reading is ableist. Mostly it's white professors that come up with these acronyms and theories. And, but I'm just saying I'm not a Nazi. Actually indigenous, like visibly a brown person. And it's funny that they compared us to Milo Yiannopoulos. And I think this is interesting because Milo Yiannopoulos is gay. And there's been some people that are queer radicals that say he's not gay anymore. Because
that's interesting.
Gay doesn't
more than where you put your penis.
Yeah, it's not like a Foucauldian behavior, it's an essential thing that means you're somehow vaguely progressive.
You're good. You're part of the club. You're part of the community.
So they're saying that I'm not native because a real native could never have these opinions. And it's also funny because I don't give a fuck. I'm not one of these people in Oakland that always proclaims my identity to get what I want, because these people, they don't understand what Ojibwe means. They don't even know what that is.
Right, of course.
So it's, but another extreme thing that happened is they put graffiti all over the house in like all the rooms. But one of our roommates compared basically having a bro over, me, the bro, to the Holocaust. She's Jewish and she left a statement saying that this is basically like driving someone to the ovens.
Yeah, she wrote on the walls in her room, what does it say exactly? All violence, no matter how small, is evil, something like that. And then saying, my ancestors walked into the ovens understanding control and manipulation, or something along those lines. She wrote these in huge black letters on two of the walls, taking up both the entirety of the walls. The ironic thing is, like, we found some subletters to move in because of the short notice. The subletter who's in her room is a black Jew, and he's the one who has to wake up every morning and night, you know, looking at this. She didn't write it in my room, you know? It doesn't really affect me, but I am obviously very angry in this situation and somewhat reactive, but
if I died
in the Holocaust and my granddaughter wrote that, I would actually be kind of pissed off.
Yeah. Haunt their ass?
Oh, I don't know if I'd do that, but I'd be kind of like, what are you doing, honey?
Yeah, this is fascinating because Dominique is actually visibly upset. And whereas you have a bit more of an objective affect. But
I expect people to be rational and share my values just like everyone else does.
Yeah, because you really haven't had a lot of the direct exposure to this sort of behavior.
Nor have you had to really deal with roommate situations.
No, not like, and I absolutely detest punks and Oakland black clad subculture. It's not my thing.
Yeah. Except you come from it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I made it out.
Yeah. Okay. So how does this matter and how is this a lesson for the rest of your life?
I think I like being excluded. And that's something that I've really been thinking about over the past few days, that like I don't really want to pretend to be part of a community that I'm not if it just results in this. It just seems better for everyone if I exclude myself a little more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems like you'd kind of, the first mistake here was letting these people move in.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the nice thing about calling the new people who moved in subletters is that you have a bit more control in the situation.
Yeah.
But it seems like, and you know, obviously I've made this mistake also, when you let certain kinds of people into your life, usually out of desperation, usually the results suck.
Yeah. But there's something to exclusivity if we can, if we're privileged enough to like make that work. Maybe let's think of it as less about exclusion, a little bit more about exclusivity. That perhaps I am being called out as being a racist and a fascist and all these things amongst some people, at least, or being called that.
What do people mean when they use those words? Because obviously, you know, all three of us here at the table are being called these terms all the time. And, you know, mostly in my case, they're either anonymous or so far away that I cannot reach them. what do you think, like, to treat people positively, what do they mean when they use these words? Do they just mean bad?
I mean, that's my understanding, really. Like, that's how I think of it, is it's just, it's a bad word, particularly fascist. has become almost meaningless. Yeah. I mean, when there are real fascists in the world, I find it really fascinating that people will point their finger and shout fascist at anything, like things that have nothing to do with nationalism whatsoever. It doesn't make sense to me. It's like, do you know the definition of fascist? But
Dominique, do you have thoughts?
What do you think?
What do you think people mean? To give them the total benefit of the doubt.
Honestly, in our scenario, it seems like they didn't like us because we have different aesthetics and we don't care about the things that they do, and their magic words don't work on us. I guess there's something about the idea of wanting to be comfortable that I also understand the urge. I understand being stressed out living in the Bay Area and living in a really mistake of a world. But I also have been toying with this idea of that a lot of this behavior is a kind of a hidden appeal to the patriarch in a way. And in your talk, you refer to the sky god. And I want to hear more of what you mean by that. But I feel like there's something about this ideology of identity stuff where people just think that there's a platonic form of how things should be, and that some form of morality that's kind of omniscient will protect them. And I don't think that that's going to happen.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, one of the accusations that was made early on when quote unquote PC culture came around was the accusation of it being, you know, implicitly Maoist. And you know, and I basically personally would still make that criticism, but a lot of people have really got shouted down and really disabused of the notion that it has anything to do with Maoism. But of course, to the extent to which it does, there's a state that somehow is going to, at the end of the day, protect the rights of the disenfranchised, or there's some power that is sky god-esque in its implications. And I think that that's interesting because it's, you know, again, like I in fact believe that there is a Maoist cabal that is in fact like that has targeted anarchists and anarchism, and that where they've really been successful is in Oakland. That's my personal opinion. I've said it in writing. And were either of you there when the reading group was attacked for this?
No.
Yeah, this was about 3 or 4 years ago. A couple people, I wrote this piece about basically Maoism and anyways. Mm-hmm. So I think that on some level, in this case, we could talk about what does it look like to follow Maoist revolutionary pedagogy through and to see to what extent what we're experiencing is the secular version of that, right? Because obviously most of the people that we know, they still call themselves anarchists. Mm-hmm. Well, Maoists don't care what you call yourself.
Yeah.
Right? They're more than happy to take another people's system of jargon, to take another people's system of even of ideas, and to wrap it in their sort of vision of how to proceed. And part of that process is the idea of articulating to a community that they are a colony inside a colonial power, and that their task vis-a-vis Fanon, vis-a-vis Third World Liberation struggles, is to usurp that colonial power. And I mean, that is what the people that we're talking about are doing.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
But this is not like a Fanonian situation at all. The material conditions are not ripe for artists in Oakland to overthrow
other artists in Oakland.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wish that there was something more interesting to talk about.
Have you read Sakai's Settlers?
I don't believe so.
That's where the hinge is here.
Okay.
Because it's basically like, and I have to admit, like, there's some of the place here where I'm a little weak. So I had always assumed that Race Traitor was part of the same story, and I'm not exactly sure that that's true. I've actually met some people around the race traitor scene, and they've surprised me in terms of their similar analysis around some of these topics. So leaving them aside, there is a racial analysis that sort of, that Settlers is sort of like one of the pivotal books about, but that basically says that if you can't win the actual fight, the fight against the actual material upper class, that you fight the war against the quote unquote settlers. So in the context that we're talking about of your particular drama, I mean, that's the setup, is that if you're not in our jargon space, like, and, mm-hmm. and obviously like each wash, it gets sort of weaker and weaker, right? I mean, like, you know, we're talking about the third and fifth generations of how this stuff has come. Even if you talk about, Bell Hooks as being another pivotal figure in this, because I don't think that Bell Hooks intended her stuff to get used like it's getting used, similar to Foucault. I don't think Foucault intended that his stuff to get used in the way that it's getting used. But what happens when it gets washed mm-hmm. by another generation? Anyways.
Yeah, well, and I feel like Dominique and I have kind of, we've discussed this a lot. We're both readers and perhaps somewhat analytically oriented, but a lot of people are learning this language from memes. And so the applications of it, although sometimes may be accurate and spot on, sometimes they're not. And also there's, I don't know, maybe something about meme culture where it's just like you just use it for everything and share it with everyone or something like that, where it's like all of a sudden it's so easy to accuse anyone of fascism.
Sure.
I have a sort of a story about bell hooks and this anti-intellectual style, or I don't know what it is. It's definitely a phenomenon because I'm at this pretty prestigious college and taking ethnic studies classes. There happened to be a Jewish professor who was considered white by the class, in that the class did like a 2-day sit down because the professor's white. Which is funny that our roommates are using their Jewish identity, because it doesn't really jive with the Black Indigenous analysis. Sure. But so they had this protest in the classroom, and their demands were to have less exams and to have easier grades. I'm not making this up. But and then one of the funniest things that they said was that they said that reading bell hooks was too academic, that it was too complicated and jargony. Like, they won't even read. It is kind of like we're in a completely different situation, and no one is probably going to kill me, but it kind of feels like Pol Pot shit.
Sure.
In some ways.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, where George Orwell was so smart in talking about newspeak. Mm-hmm. The process by which language becomes the reverse of itself. Mm. I mean, that's such a devious concept, yeah. and definitely one that I see happen around me all the time. I mean, I really can't tell you the number of circumstances where I've suffered under this same thing. And recently, you know, seeing my own words sort of turned against me over and over and over again, in such a decontextualized way that I have no idea what the original intention of, you know, what it is that I said was, but I'm shocked to discover what it is, because of course someone's going to tell me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, meme culture is fascinating because I guess it is sort of the end game of an anti-intellectual culture. Because of course, most times, like, memes are extremely sharp little pinpricks. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to confuse that with something different because it does sting. Like, a lot of times they're right.
Yeah.
If you see the world in exactly the alignment of that the meme is in.
It's not so different than slogans, too, with activism. Just the slogan in general, or the tagline or the byline or whatever you want to call it, rather than having, like, a real argument, it's just a three-word statement.
Sure. Yeah. Although nowadays it just doesn't seem like many slogans have that much power.
No. They become meaningless. There are too many of them.
Yeah. Right.
They're all taken. All the good ones.
All the good ones are taken. Yeah. And they've been turned into Apple commercials. So exclusion. Yeah. So, okay. So your response to exclusion is to choose exclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like, especially how does that look different when the two of you are a couple? And then a lot of couples tend to have a feeling of us against the world, babe. And that sort of solitude of a love that the world can't understand.
The situation has certainly reinforced that feeling.
Yeah. No, sure.
I think becoming more insular and also just much more selective about the people that I share time and resources with. In the past, I think I have been overly friendly. And I have a fairly open disposition, and I've never had a particular need to have friends who share my values or interests. Like, I have a broad group of friends and different ideologies, different perspectives, and that's never bothered me. I enjoy that, and I'd like to still enjoy that, but perhaps I need to be a little, somewhere in the middle, you know, somewhere in the middle. What about you, Dominique?
Well, I just want to, like, compare it to approaches to politics or life philosophies, and that it's not important to me to feel like I'm part of this big queer scene in Oakland. Sure. And I have a smaller group of friends that we have known each other for a long time and relate on things specifically. So I'm comparing that to stuff like social anarchism and then these non-red anarchist positions that would be like, I have all these friends, right, is social anarchism. And this is more of like, being selective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about this in terms of its political expression, because I think that more and more people do identify with this thing that I think that we also share, which is that there are anarchists who define the anarchist project as social change or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that means making compromises on the I for the we, and getting as many we's as possible to make a meaningful impact on the on the social order and everyone else. And I think that by and large, anarchists, you know, because they attracted lots of like loser activists, and by that I mean people who took on like causes that were not ever possible, like you know, back in the old days, a lot of anarchists, you know, came out of like recycling communities, right? The first people who recycled before city governments took it over, and people who were into bicycles, right? I mean, critical mass, a lot of, you know, very loopy anarchist types, like, you know, middle-aged men in the middle of nowhere would be on their bikes all the time as like their personal statement. And I think that because that has looked like what anarchism has been, a lot of people, when they're introduced to these ideas, think that they mean the same thing as maybe not becoming that person, but maybe not being a loser activist, but maybe being a winning activist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, and I think that one of the hard things about going against that particular threat is that we don't have nearly the smooth language to talk about what our project is. You know, like, I'll oftentimes say that, you know, perhaps like my anarchism is a living anarchism that tries to express itself in daily life. But obviously there, I'm coding myself as being a post-situationist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm coding myself as defining anarchism on my own terms rather than on the terms of let's say, changing the world.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that I want to be more confident with, not just with this podcast, but with my other projects, is the fact that I don't think the preponderance of people are on the other team. I think that that's actually a lie that social anarchists have told themselves, and they've been able to, because the nature of the attraction of their position is that everyone's doing it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I think it's true.
Yeah.
I mostly say that because, you know, right now, the town of Olympia, Washington seems to be at war with Little Black Cart. And the number of people who are reaching out to me from Olympia, Washington right now would shock you. Mm. Yeah, and I think that it's always been the assumption that particular attitude was the dominant attitude in anarchism.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure it's the case anymore.
It's interesting. I mean, this is such a tawdry criticism, and perhaps I'm doing exactly what I've been complaining of other people of doing, but it just seems so democratic to say, mm-hmm. where are the majority? You're either on the majority or you're not, or something like that. It's kind of baffling to me why an anarchist would ever use that argument.
Would care, yeah.
Yeah, or care, yeah, exactly. But I like to refer to it as leftist fundamentalism.
Yeah, and that it is.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, part of my goal in talking about exclusion, especially from different people's perspectives, and it's weird to say this, but I think that we are the project of the excluded, which is strange to say as an anarchist project. And, you know, when you look at anarchist publishing prior to the 90s, and you look at projects like Lumpanix or Faro House, mm-hmm. Or even Left Bank, mm-hmm. By and large, what they published didn't have an orthodoxy.
Yeah.
I mean, there definitely was a libertine orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. There was a, you know, sort of like America on the frontier type of a mm-hmm. orthodoxy. And don't tell me what to do. And that, to me, is the enemy of what it is that we're talking about right now.
Yes, yeah.
Like when we're talking about exclusion, we're talking about social sets that are trying to establish themselves and their power, and once they have it, are trying to dictate terms mm-hmm. to other people. And so it's curious to me to think about, how do you resist that? What does it look like to resist that in an urban environment? What does it look like to resist that when you're when you don't want to? What does it look like to consciously resist it and to unconsciously resist it? And I'm curious as to your thoughts.
Well, I think it's going to be different for anyone, like person to person. I think it's easy for me to say, fine, you think I'm a Nazi, you think I'm a fascist, I don't care. I don't care. But I'm also not dependent on having some kind of public image necessarily. For other people, perhaps they have a lifestyle or they're dependent on resources that is more tied to that. To having a face.
A lot of people around you, that's the case.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, those people couldn't have moved out of your place if they didn't have a place to go.
Yeah.
They must have talked to some part of their circle of friends mm-hmm. who was like, you can sleep on my couch until you find another place, or we have a sublet opening up.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But also, I think this question, like, I'm a black metal musician, and I'm involved in like really extreme noise and just kind of sketchy in my personal interests. But I just want to say that I'm interested in transgression. Like, it's okay. Like, I'll get in fights with people. I'm not from the suburbs. I grew up in prison, and my idea of conflict is different. But the reason I'm saying this is I don't think just being reactionary is enough to me, and I don't just like to break taboos because they're there. It's like I want something else. I don't know how to get to that, but yeah. I'm not just going to be, I would get called edgelord by people, but I don't want to be chained to identity politics, and I don't like how feminist and men's rights people can communicate and talk about the same issues in our mirrors. And I don't want to be a mirror to whatever's happening.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. I think I might sound a little bit more reactive in this conversation than I often do. It's difficult, though, to not be reactive when people are making these types of accusations that, honestly, it just seems so out of pocket. It's tempting for me to be like, oh, you think I'm a racist? Well, then I'll act racist.
Yeah.
That's where the dark part of my mind goes. Sure. Oh, I just said dark as a negative thing. I guess that's racist. See?
Mm-hmm. It's where the white part of your mind goes.
Yeah, yeah. There we go.
But it pisses them off, too. That's part of it. That
sure.
Saying these things, like, it's so easy that the people that are into this ideology, they tell you their triggers. They literally say,
yes,
these are the things mm-hmm. that are going to hurt me. These words will kill me. This mm-hmm. is violent. They tell you what weapons to use against them. But I think they also don't really believe in this in an analytical way. But maybe as somewhat of a religious system in a way, or mm-hmm. Something like a subculture, but I guess part of it is that I don't think that their subculture really exists, and I don't think it's really possible to have what's happening, and things are going to get more complicated, more
We're
than they already
excluded.
Are. Yeah.
Everyone is excluded.
Well, right. I mean, that is one of the reasons, you know, where, so there's obviously something to say about Maoism in here, but you know, one of the, when we never talk about class, which, you know, you actually did bring it up in different words, a lot of the people we're talking about come from middle class families and values and neighborhoods, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and they're trying out a different political system in a sort of sandbox. And it used to be that sandbox was bigger.
Yeah.
And you could have different sorts of types of attempts being made the same way. What's strange right now, given the incredible constraints that are happening in the Oakland group house space, what's amazing to me is how little is sort of being blamed on the landlords. I mean, it's the landlords that are making people crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, and instead it's... The blame goes to the person whose house you're living in or with. And
yeah.
That to me is where the disconnect is happening. Perhaps it's happening because these people can return to where they're from. No harm, no foul. They get to go on and, you know, write their books about whatever. Actually a perfect example of this, and, you know, because I'm older, you know, the women out of the Riot Girl scene who got to write books were of a type.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Right.
That's another example of ideas coming out of academia. When you talk to the grad students and the professors, sometimes they're pretty smart. I hate to admit it.
Sure.
And there's a lot more nuance, but a lot of times people will take concepts and completely invert them.
Yeah.
And I think you're talking about class, and that's where, like, the idea of intersectionality,
yeah,
which makes me feel kind of nauseous
so
to say
abused,
it,
yeah.
But it's used to mean in these social scenes and on the internet that basically only Black, disabled, lesbians
yeah.
with autism, only they... are oppressed, or they're most oppressed in that other people are implicit. But really, my understanding of intersectionality means that class is an intersection.
Yes.
Is an axis, and people will never bring up class.
Yeah,
it'll be like, I'm queer, I'm brown, but they always leave out their other...
Yeah.
criteria, which is they're from Santa Barbara and they're doing fine,
mm-hmm.
you know. But if you were to bring up class, then it falls apart. But those are their own ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think people are really discounting the incredible flexibility of capitalism. Like, capitalism is running the table.
Yeah.
And they really are happy to allow the possible rebels to squabble about this stupid shit,
mm-hmm.
Because by and large, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, not just to speak to the disparity of of wealth and income, but the haves and the have-nots, neither the twain shall meet. I mean, I don't live a life where I get to see a have ever. And I work in a, you know, cubicle farm and in an office building. Mm-hmm. And
sure, and that's why I'm saying I wish there was something more interesting to talk about. But if we're talking about exclusion in radical scenes, then this is really what's happening to a lot of people. Yeah, and I'm attracted to the situationist formations of not just focusing on a worker in a specific way, but that we're all fucked by this shit.
Yeah.
And I really don't think we're going to get together and have a rupture. But I don't think it helps to have people think that we're all the enemy of each other when we're all getting screwed over. But maybe we are all each other's enemies.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that we believe that is, like, you know, I oftentimes, when you catch me in a nice mood, will say that the only chance that there was for a social revolution in this country was at the peak of the workers, the peak of the workers' movement. In other words, that the workers were the only group that if they truly self-identified themselves as being opposed to the owning class, they actually, when they were coordinated, had the strength, the power, the sinew to actually advent that change. And that ever since, that has been impossible. And so just to talk about that, like on the sort of revolutionary level, which obviously mostly I don't talk about. And so now we live in a post-revolutionary time. In other words, any conversation like this, like, I don't think we should go back to that time, because obviously the revolution that we would have accomplished isn't necessarily one that I would have wanted to live in. But let's not lie to ourselves. Especially, let's not lie to ourselves that the weakness of the Oakland group house scene is actually a strength. It is not.
Yeah.
It's just weakness.
Yeah.
And it's weakness of the scale where individuals and couple forms and whatever can be excluded. That's its power. That's it. But you know, to speak to the larger anarchist space and sort of like, how do we create it in our image, and how do we create it in our vision? That's, to me, why I want to talk about exclusion. And I'm curious, here in the last 10 minutes or so, what your thoughts are on that. And you can use Black Seed as an example.
Mm-hmm. Can you rephrase the question slightly? I'm just kind of scrambling a little bit. Sorry.
If anarchism up till now, actually I'll use an example. And then maybe I've told one or both of you this example already, but a few weeks ago, I had a very serious conversation with a serious anarchist person who's more in the social anarchist world. And they basically sat down, looked me in the eye and said, no one will work with you because you are not nice. Now, they're right.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're meaning no one, their definition of no one are the people that they work with, are the people that agree with them and that vibe with their politics.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, there's tons of people that work with me.
Yeah, and I think you're nice.
Okay. But. No, well, so one direction to take that in is, what do we mean when we say nice?
Uh-huh.
I mean, well, the reason that I sort of appreciated this moment was because whatever else you might say about this person I had this conversation with, they are a person that comes from middle-class values.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, when a person from middle-class values says that someone is nice, it has a particular meaning that I'm happy to not qualify as.
Yeah.
You know, am I able to, like, use a fork and knife and you know, sure. But I guess my point and the larger point that I'm sort of bringing up is there is a battle happening for the heart of the anarchist soul.
I see, yeah.
And the cheesy way to describe it is the difference between anarchism and anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I will not fall back on that is because it makes it too trite.
Yeah.
But I do think that this conversation about exclusion, about what do our sets look like, and about being explicit about desiring a stake in that particular fight. In other words, like, I want anarchism to look different than it looked in 1937.
Yeah.
I think that the old values are old and done and show their limitation.
Well, I guess I wish that people would, this would be my wish, that we could allow ourselves to have differences of opinion and perhaps search out people that there is more shared perspective and kind of stay out of each other's projects a little bit more. Which to me, I mean, it's so much just like the concept of the affinity group or something like that. Like, this is not a new shocking revelation within anarchism, but I don't understand the need to say you are excluded from anarchism. You're not a part of this movement. You're not a part of this project. You are a bad person.
Whatever. If you don't like a TASA, don't buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. why not?
Sure.
Why can't we have, I don't know. I'm so like post-activism. I'm like my skin is crawling, but I'm going to use the word movement. If we are going to think of it as a movement or anything in that way, like a progressive thing that's growing or expanding forward, then we have to actually employ diversity of tactics and let people do different things and have different perspectives, right? I mean, to me, that was always a part of it.
Well, but that is one of the hard things about exclusion.
Yeah.
It's hard to have diversity of tactics if instead of doing different stuff, people split with each other mm-hmm. every time they decide to do something different.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's also, there's something to people that are outcasts or ideas that are unpopular that you could have some common ground around that. And I'm thinking of like ways that you can be pluralistic and how things can become sectarian. It's so a lot of primitivism's reactions to black seed forming were that it was not taking on the mantle of green anarchy, which meant a specific definition of anti-civilization around technology or domestication or whatever their list of jargon is. And what drew me to green anarchy in the old days was definitely the fact that it's was explicitly saying we're drawing from the situationist and nihilist and egoism and primitivism and all this stuff, like deep ecology. And I think we would probably draw, we do draw from different places, but it was the idea that you could want to like fuck shit up or have a different view about how our lives are. And you could sit side by side with each other. And it's disappointing that the primy people are like, it was always our thing.
Yeah.
None of these other, it's kind of like calling people Nazis, and I keep feeling like calling people leftist as an ad hominem.
But like, it's hard to avoid.
Just like the Stalin erasing his homeboy's picture. It's stuff like that.
Yeah. No, I definitely want to be really, really cautious about that because, you know, while it tends to be the leftism in a particular person's ideology that I'm the most repulsed by or whatever, that leftism came from somewhere. And, and, you know, obviously I was really disappointed, you know, because obviously we had an article by John in the first issue of Black Seed. And then the fact that he distanced himself so quickly from the project, mostly because Kevin Tucker was really upset that there were criticisms of anthropology, right there in the editorial. And like the, you know, it's not acceptable to even criticize anthropology. I mean, that seems shocking, but obviously in hindsight, it appears that where that tendency was at in its trajectory was at a place where it wanted to be pretty isolated and no longer really accept input and just what do output. I mean, fuck, it really hasn't accepted input since Man the Hunter.
That was before I was born. So
yeah, me
I'm
too.
Late to the party.
As a matter of fact. Wasn't it 68?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, that was before I was born. Okay, well, just to wrap this up, and obviously this has been a lot of fun, and I apologize for speechifying, but you know, I'm trying to keep this focused on on the exclusion part of this conversation. And you know, of course, a lot of the times the podcast is the place where I actually come to like I come to conclusions of things I want to say better in verbally than I do necessarily in writing, which is sad for me as a writer, but I guess good for me as a podcaster. So what do we do? What's next?
What's next? Well, Black Seed. I think maybe part of my exclusivity or something, or my own exclusion, I still want to turn into a stone or something. I don't really want to be human. I'm pretty over all of this humanity and pathos and drama right now.
I mean, now that Tom Petty is gone.
Yeah, yeah.
What's left?
So yeah, let's turn into stones or something else and try to. Trees.
I'm really uncomfortable that you would mention Tom Petty. That's kind of transgressive to me.
That is pretty much the opposite of black metal.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, honestly, black metal is a joke, and yeah. Tom Petty and mass shootings, it's like all the same shit, basically.
I mean, the sad thing about something like Tom Petty, who I basically can't name a song by, is that I was raised in more environments where Tom Petty was playing than, you know, I mean, like talk about classic rock stations and you know, like what the Midwest is really like. Like, I remember Van Halen, like, being a thing that people were, like, into. Mm-hmm. That's not what, like, you know, the cool kids in Oakland are into. Let's say that. But anyways, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Rest in peace, Tom Petty. Thank you, Aragorn.
Yeah, bye.